President Hanna, members of the Board of Trustees, members of the faculties, members of the graduating classes, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. President, you pay me a great tribute by inviting me to speak at this great university on this auspicious occasion. I dedicate my remarks this afternoon to Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, who I believe would endorse what I shall try to say this afternoon if he were here. We will do many wonderful things with the mind in the years ahead. Longevity will be further extended. The number of people living 90 and 100 years old will increase. Many more diseases will be conquered. Cancer will eventually be cured. We will very soon place a man on the moon. Passenger planes will soon be flying 1,000 miles an hour. We will develop more deadly implements of war. The comforts of life will be multiplied many times. Soon we will have more leisure time than we know how to use. We will increase the number of college graduates, and the number of PhDs will be treble. More brilliant scholars will be born. Shakespeare was partly right when he makes Hamlet say, "What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how expressed and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god." Modern man has more than fulfilled the expectation of Alexander Pope when he says in his essay on man, "Go, wondrous creature, mount where science guides. Go, measure earth, weigh air, and state the tides. Instruct the planets in what orbs to run. Correct old time and regulate the sun." I hope the university will always be what Disraeli says it is, a center of light, liberty, and learning. In this sense, the university's work will never be finished. But a university must be more. As marvelous as man is, he has not yet conquered three of the major enemies of mankind: war, poverty, and racism. It will not be enough for our universities to train their graduates how to make themselves secure in the economic and political world and insulate themselves from the basic issues of our time. The day has come for educational institutions to train their students to be seriously concerned about a commitment to eliminate war, abolish poverty, and exterminate racism. Education has done very little towards creating a world in which mankind can live without war. I can give you no blueprint as to what the role of the university in this area should be. I do know, however, that the trained mind has provided the instruments that are capable of destroying the human family. To the contrary, education is not to train the mind so that man will be able to live in a world without war. When it comes to war, it can be argued with considerable logic that man is no more civilized today than he was 35 centuries ago. Before the dawn of the Christian era, the Persians, the Babylonians, and the Egyptians sought to settle their differences on the battlefield. We do the same thing today. We are wiser than they, certainly better educated, but we do not know how to make universal peace. We thought, when we fought World War I, that we were fighting the war that would end wars. Americans fought and died on the battlefields of Europe under the slogan, "We are fighting to make the world safe for democracy." Woodrow Wilson believed that, and he made us believe it too, that World War I was the last war in history, the war to end wars. We learn nothing from that tragic experience. Millions died, millions more were crippled and maimed. And 2 decades after World War I, we found ourselves in World War II engaged in the same folly. We followed the Second World War with Korea, and for a decade we have been bogged down in Vietnam. We have more colleges and universities than ever before, building more at the rate of one a week. But education is wholly irrelevant when it comes to providing ways to build a war-free world. We have fought 3,300 wars in 3,000 years. In the last 3,500 years, man has been at war somewhere on the earth 9 out of every 10 hours. Education has given us more facts and better trained minds, but it has hardly made us any more sensitive to the perils of war. We are spending $2 billion a month in Vietnam and some $45 billion annually on past, present, and future wars. With this amount of money, we could endow every college and university in the United States with $22,500,000 each, and at 5%, each of the 2,000 colleges and universities would have an additional income of $1,125,000 a year. When it comes to the need to eliminate war, our educational institutions are largely irrelevant. Our purpose seems to be to help students develop their minds in order that they might be able to get ahead in the world, and not how they might use their minds to establish programs designed to eliminate the conditions that keep mankind forever at war. Some university should list as one of its major objectives a blueprint for universal peace. The question of mankind's survival is too critical a matter to be left entirely in the hands of politicians and heads of state. Make no mistake, we will abolish war, or war will abolish mankind. The second problem confronting mankind, and to which universities should give priority, is the question of poverty. Poverty not only in far-off Asia and Africa, but poverty in the affluent USA. When we say that half of the people of the earth are not getting enough to eat, are malnutritioned, and have diseased bodies, we are unaware of the amount of hunger and malnutrition that exist in our own country. Within the last 10 months, it has been my privilege to be a member of a team to study hunger and malnutrition in the United States. Hunger and malnutrition exist in every section of the United States, north, east, south, and west. The federal government admits that in 1967, there were 8,876,700 families in the United States in poverty, or 29,900,000 persons, 15% of the population, recognized by the federal government as impoverished. In 1967, it is estimated that there were 50 million children of school age in the United States, and 6 million of them came from poor families, families with annual income below $3,300. Only 2 million received free lunches, leaving 4 million poor children without lunch. Millions of these kids are hungry at home and have no money with which to buy food at school. These are the poor, black and white, red and brown, Catholic and Protestant. Many children go to school without breakfast and too hungry to learn, and are too hungry to learn, and are in such pain that they must be taken home. In some cases, mothers keep their children from school so that at least they can cry themselves to sleep from hunger in their mother's arms. Right here in the United States, in some areas, there are pregnant mothers so ill-nourished that a minimum of blood transfusion must be given routinely to each pregnant mother as a part of her regular prenatal care. Studies have been made that show that some pregnant mothers do not get sufficient iron, calcium, and calories, so the nutritionally motivated craving for iron and calcium leads them to eat clay and to eat starch for calories to supplement their food. There are thousands of babies being born daily who have protein deficiencies during their early years, and it has been established that protein deficiency in early childhood can cause permanent brain damage, cause an IQ deficit of as many as 18 to 22 points, from which the child will never recover. These kids are not inherently dumb. When they are properly fed, if they were properly fed, they would develop good minds, and some of them would be brilliant. There are people in the United States, and possibly in your city, who go to the city dump digging for food. When the dump trucks come, the people are there going through the garbage to get cheese, butter, meat, donuts, or whatever is edible that has been thrown away. I have recently talked with widows living on $45 per month, mothers with seven children trying to make it on $200 a month. I know of a case where a woman, 26, two children, and a husband unable to work, are virtually starving. The lady said to an interviewer, and I quote her, "One thing we always got is milk, cause my ma keeps a goat. We don't always eat the same all the time. One day I will fix macaroni for lunch. The next day, spaghetti or potatoes. So we get a little variety too. I had steak once, about 3 months ago. A friend of my husband was serving it and invited us over. Imagine that, me going 26 years without tasting steak. I took one little bitty bite and said, boy, it sure was worth waiting for." End of the quote. We found another case where a woman has 12 children, ages 3 and a half to 21, living on $130 a month. After this woman pays rent, electricity, and heat, she has $90 a month to get food for 13. There are no free lunches, and she cannot get welfare because she cannot tell welfare where her husband is. Our colleges and universities certainly should not educate ourselves and our students away from the problems of the poor. We should know the conditions and circumstances under which the poor live in the slums and in the ghettos and in the rural areas. And wherever possible, universities should become so involved that we will help to build a United States where no family of four will get less than $3,300 a year, where every able-bodied man will be guaranteed a job with a minimum adequate wage, where good schools exist, and where educational facilities are adequate. The problem of poor people should be the concern of the universities, and how to eliminate poverty should be one of its major objectives. We must eliminate poverty, not only because it's right to do so, but because there will be no security for none of us until we do. The third and final enemy of mankind, which our colleges and universities should seek to abolish, is racism. It is difficult for us to understand that racism does exist in the United States. However, some of us did not have to be told by the President's Commission on Civil Rights Disorder that it does exist. We know it from years of bitter experiences. Ruth Benedict defined racism as follows, and I quote, "Racism is the dogma that one ethnic group is condemned by nature to hereditary inferiority, and another group is destined to hereditary superiority. It is the dogma that the hope of civilization depends upon eliminating some races and keeping others pure. It is the dogma that one race has carried progress throughout human history and alone ensures future progress." End of quotation. Anyone, whether black or white, who believes that he is inherently superior to the members of other races has earned the right to be called a racist. Slavery and segregation, which have been with us in this country for a total of 350 years, are proof that there is racism in this country. Virtually all civil rights legislations and victories in federal courts designed to make our democracy applicable to Negroes came about through some kind of coercion. Negroes are the only people in the United States who have had to spend tens of billions of dollars to get what the Constitution guarantees them and what all white persons get by virtue of being born white. No other ethnic or racial group has had to sit in and demonstrate in order to have places of public accommodation open to them. No other group has had to sue for equality in education. No white group has had to sue in federal courts in order to get the ballot. No white group has had to coerce Congress to pass a bill to prohibit discrimination in housing. No other group found it necessary to sponsor a march on Washington 250,000 strong to make Congress know that we will pay any price to eliminate second-class citizenship in the United States. 14 years after the May the 17th, 1954 decision of the United States Supreme Court outlawing segregation in the public schools, many sections of the nation are still resisting the court orders. 85% of our public schools are still segregated. Martin Luther King Jr. should never have been assassinated with the approval of millions because he wanted America to live up to its pronouncement. It is not only good for the United States to eliminate racism, but it is good for the world that we do it, because there will be no permanent peace on the earth until we do. Despite black power or those who argue for separatism, the destiny of white and Negro America is still one destiny. It must be one of education's aim to strive to desegregate and integrate America to the end that this great nation of ours, born in revolution and blood, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created free and equal, will truly become the lighthouse of freedom, where none will be denied because his skin is black, and none favored because his eyes are blue, where the nation is militarily strong, but at peace, economically secure but just, learned but wise, and where the poorest will have a job and bread enough and to spare. Educators should define the kind of world we are trying to build. We should have ways of measuring the progress in goodness and in the development of our right attitudes, just as we measure the progress of intellectual development and our right attitude, just as we define the progress in intellectual development. After defining the kind of society we want to build, we should develop skills and techniques designed to make our students that kind of citizen. Goodness is important as literacy. An honest heart is as important as a brilliant mind. The assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy makes it all the more urgent that we build the kind of world which I have tried to describe. Senator Kennedy was committed to a program of peace. He wanted poverty abolished and racism exterminated. It is too bad that we live in a world where men like John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Robert Francis Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Mahatma Gandhi are in as much danger at being killed as murderers and thieves. Members of the classes of 1968, I predict that most of you will be very successful in your chosen fields. Some of you will become famous. Some of you will accumulate great wealth. Some of you will occupy positions of prestige and power. My best wishes go with you. Whatever you do, however, I implore you to become involved in worthy programs designed to make a better world. I hope you will never turn your back on the millions who are poor, but rather do your part to enable them to rise to positions of respectability and honor. I hope you will never be satisfied until America is committed to the proposition that equality, freedom, and justice are the God-given rights of every American. For no man is good enough. No man is wise enough. No man is rich enough. And no man is strong enough to look down on another man. We are what we are by fate, by accident, or by the grace of God. No man chooses his parents, and no man chooses the place where he is to be born. I affirm in closing the words of Eugene Debs when he said, as long as there is a lower class, I am in it. As long as there is a criminal element, I am of it. As long as there is a man in jail, I am not free. I challenge you, therefore, members of the classes of 1968, to join in a crusade to eliminate poverty, abolish war, and exterminate racism.